Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
And we'd like to welcome everybody back to the Football's Family Podcast. We're going to do a show today that is not based on football, but based on the city that I am right next to and the city that I'm very, very well familiar with. I live in a little town called Hurricane Mills, but I live outside of a town called Waverly, Tennessee. And not too long ago, it'd be 3 years ago in August, we suffered a tragedy when we had about 22 people die as a result of a flash flood. And I remember that vividly, as we probably all do, that if you grew up in this area, you know what I'm talking about. But before that, 1978, if I remember correctly, there was another tragedy that took place here in Waverly that my guest today wrote a book about. Before I introduce her or let her introduce herself, I also have a special guest, my dad, who was on my first Thanksgiving episode, Mark McFarland. He is with you. Daddy, you want to say hi to everybody?
Good afternoon.
There we go.
Now, glad to be here.
We're glad that you're here. Now, would my guest like to introduce herself and tell about the book you wrote? Give us the title.
Sure. I'm Dr. Yasmeen Ali, author of Walk Through Fire, The Train Disaster That Changed America.
It's a fantastic book. My dad and I both read it, and I was reading over it again before I got up in here. And Dr. Ali, the neat thing about this book, because my dad and I are both history, students of history. If I'd done it correctly, I would have double majored at Fried Hardman in history. We have been to places. We have seen places. When I got to go to Scotland a few years ago, I stepped foot in Glencoe, and I read about that, and I read about, William Wallace, and got to see these places. But your book about and you're going to explain it just a little bit, your book about walking through fire here in Waverly, yesterday, I kid you not, I did the funeral of Mr. Richard Wheeler, who was involved with this. I talked to Buddy Frazier, who was involved with this. I talked to Mr. Frank Craver, who was involved with this. It's neat to see something that's as historical as this, and it was a terrible episode, but to be able to talk to people that were there.
Yes, exactly. And so just so your listeners know what we're talking about here, not everybody may have heard of the Waverly train disaster of 1978. So this is what happened. On the cold night of Wednesday, February 22nd, 1978, a 96-car L&N freight train derailed in the center of my hometown, Waverly, Tennessee. And among the 23 wrecked cars were two white 30,000-gallon tankers full of liquid propane. And then 2 days later, at 2:55 p.m. on that afternoon of Friday, February 24th, 1978, one of those propane tankers exploded during the cleanup efforts. And that explosion took 16 lives and all of Waverly's Newtown section with it. More than 200 people were injured. So those are the statistics. But as you've alluded to, Jeremy, this book is about so much more than that. It's about the people. It's about the people who are involved, the people that you know, that I had known all my life and hadn't really understood the magnitude of what they went through until I started talking to them and hearing their stories. And I realized I really wanted to put this in a book and honor and make this a tribute to them as first responders and as heroes, really, in this disaster.
And you do, Daddy, if you want to jump in, just you're more than welcome to. You do a great job at the human aspect. You talk about your father. You talk about what I enjoyed about the particular thing that I read over today was the Nautilus, hospital and everything that they had to go through. Because Waverly, if you don't know the size of Waverly, it's not that big of a city.
About
We have a
4,000
Walmart.
people.
Say it again.
About 4,000 people.
Yes. Now it's not big, but we have a Walmart, we have a McDonald's, and we have a Burger King. I'm very happy about that. But it's not that big of, but when you go to Waverly, one thing that you'll see is that we recognize our past here. And I say ours, you're native here. I've been here for 15 years. They have a, you know, they have a memorial to the accident, and I posted on my Facebook page, and I'll post on the Football's Family Facebook page, pictures of the monument there. But also we're working on the monument for the flood that took place a few years ago. So people here recognize tragedies, and we respect the people like that. In your book, you talk about not only the people, you give names. Like I've worked with Mr. Bowen, Cooter Bowen. He was the one that helped me get my son's headstone finished. And like I said, I talked to Mr. Frank. I've known Richard for a long time. I didn't realize that he was involved with the explosion as well. His daughter told me yesterday that if it wasn't for the fact that he had moved the ambulance or the fire truck, he would have been right in the middle of it. I mean, how often do you get to talk to people who have experienced these things? And then you not only talked about it, you did a fine job of putting it in a book. You did. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you so much for recognizing that, because that was a key part of what this book is all about for me. I always wanted it, and I said this in the introduction in the book, that I always want it to be about the people who are involved, because we can talk about the statistics and the metal and the wheels and the machines and all the machinery. But to me, it really comes down to the people. And so, and I say this in the book as well, the reason I even thought of writing a book about the Waverly train disaster, because, you know, as you said, I'm from Waverly. I knew about this disaster. We all did, but it had never been written from start to finish. And I don't know that I would have been interested in doing it if I hadn't first talked to Mr. Toad Smith. His full name is Elton Smith. He was a police sergeant.
Little toadies.
Yes. He was a police sergeant at the time of the disaster, went on to do many great things, and goes by the nickname Toad. And he happened to stop me one day in the summer of 2011. So it's that long ago that I've been working on this. He stopped me in my parents' clinic and said, you know, just said hello, wanted to talk. And my dad, who is a surgeon, and specifically a general surgeon and trauma surgeon, and that became important with this disaster, as you know, my dad came out of an exam room and saw us talking in the hallway and called out to Mr. Smith. He said, "Mr. Smith, show her your hands." And as you know from the book, Mr. Smith's hands were burned severely and had to undergo many operations to restore the function of his hands because of this explosion. And he started telling me his story. And he's a marvelous storyteller, Jeremy. If you know him, he is just amazing in the way he tells and remembers history. And the way he told that, I thought, oh my goodness, why have I never read this before? This should be in a book. And so that started it. Now it's in a book. And you know, being from Waverly gave me a real advantage here that I don't think any other author for this particular book would have had, because I knew these people and I had a way of getting in touch with them. For instance, you read about Carolyn Tucker, my father's scrub nurse. She goes by Sam. And she heard that I was doing this. I also wanted to make sure I focused on the nurses and on the physicians who took care of these burned victims when they flooded Nautilus Memorial Hospital at the time, that tiny two-room ER. It was craziness. And they took care of all these burn victims. And I thought, how did they, you know, as a physician myself, I thought, how did they do this with the resources that they had at the time? And so I started talking to them. And then she would put me in touch with all of these other people. She'd say, you know, you need to talk to Frank Craver. And she would call up Frank Craver and say, hey, you know, Yasmin is doing a book on the train disaster. Would you talk to her? And then I would go talk to Frank Craver. And it went on and on, like Buddy Frazier. She put me in touch with him, with the other nurses I talked to. So, you know, with Dr. McClure, who's also in the book, she put me in touch with all of those people. So she really became my de facto research assistant. And I have a call out to her in my acknowledgments. This book would not have been what it was without her. So, you know, had a lot of support in doing this, and people were very kind and generous in sharing their stories. And you have to realize, I'm sure you know this, that this is, when you're talking about a tragedy and you're remembering those bad memories, that's a difficult thing to do. So I wanted to honor that too. And I realized that people were entrusting me with some of the worst memories of their lives, right? So I felt a tremendous responsibility to try and get this right.
You got a question, Daddy, or you got something you want to say? You go ahead, just do it.
Do you want me to tell you my brief story?
I would love to hear it.
Okay. Well, I was working at Jim Rife's Chevrolet in Waverly, which is no longer there. I believe it's where the DNC parts store is now. It's right beside the Waverly Church of Christ building.
Yes.
And it was to be my last few days there. I was, I'd lived in Dixon and I had obtained another job. I was working down there as the business office manager. And, of course, you know, I went through Waverly and, from the Dixon side and went through. And, you know, we had heard about it and so forth and so on. But then the day before the explosion happened, which was my next to the last day to work there, I had a reason to go down to one of the county offices, I believe, to get titles on a car or something like that that the dealership had. And it was very close to where the accident had happened. And so I went down and went up on the little bridge there, if I remember correctly, and just looked over at, you know, the wreck. And of course, I was not the only one there. But, you know, it was interesting and so forth and so on. And the book goes into marvelous detail about, you know, the individuals that were there and, you know, how they were looking at it and explore and, you know, trying to get it going again, so to speak. So anyways, I went back to my work location. The next day, I am sitting in my office. The building had a metal roof on it, And all of a sudden, the roof above my head sounds like there is a stampede running up the roof. You know, just rum, 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 rum. What in the world has happened, you know? Well, it takes a few minutes, but the word gets out, and then, of course, all the emergency vehicles start coming down the highway from that side of Waverly. And, you know, it's known that an explosion has happened, obviously. Then later on that day, I am going back to Dixon. Well, normally, of course, go up the way, you know, up through McEwen, but you didn't get to do that. We had to go Highway 13, and my memory of that is turning around in the car. I was riding with an acquaintance of mine and turning around and seeing that big column of dark smoke. If it had blown up the day before, I might not be here today or in the way that I am here today. But Chief Barnett had helped me get my job down here. And of course, he was one of those that we lost. But and that is so tragic. But to think now that the young people generation that is there now, they've got their own disaster with the flood. So that's my story.
Well, if I may ask you, Mr. McFarland, and just for Jeremy's listeners, you were referring to Waverly's chief of police, Guy Barnett, who died due to this tragedy. Waverly lost both their police chief and their fire chief in the 16 who died. It was really devastating, and half of their police force was killed or injured. So really a terrible disaster for a town of that size. But if I may ask you, since you were an observer, and it sounds like you were on the Highway 13 viaduct, we call it the viaduct, looking down over Highway 70, the bridge that takes you up.
Bridge.
Uh-huh. What did it look like to you? What do you remember seeing?
Well, I don't remember great detail, but I can remember, of course, seeing the tankers. And again, I was down there. There was a small county office just very close to that. And I think I just walked down there because, of course, they had it cordoned off. And I can't remember in precise detail, but I can just I think I can remember thinking, well, you know, the idea, because they had told us, you know, that it had gotten out, of course, that it was flammable. And that's about as much detail as I can. And it was interesting. I'll add one more little personal aspect to it. Of course, major explosion. And my wife is up in the Dixon area. And I call her. I try to, the telephone lines have been disrupted, but the dealership had a line to Nashville for business reasons. And for some reason, I could call her on the Nashville line, but I couldn't call her on the regular, the regular way between Waverly and Dixon. But I still go by, and the chief had his office, the new building that is there now, of course, wasn't there, but I still go by and I think about him being in that office many years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just listening and I was looking up to make sure I got this correct, because you read something and it goes in and out your ear. You mentioned, and this is on, anybody can find this. This is on Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is not a source to be trusted 100% of the time. We all know that. But you have researched this, Dr. Ali. I have looked in on this. Daddy was there. The chief of Waverly's fire department, Wilbur York, I believe, if I remember correctly, he was on the bridge or close by it when the explosion took place and he died. His daughter, Betty York, became Betty Davis. She attended church where I preach right now. She attended till she passed away. She told me, she wouldn't go into a lot of detail, Dr. Ali, but she told me that her dad was died as a result of this. And they told me his name. Of course, I didn't put two and two together. But the more I started reading about this, and when your book came out, I'm like, you know what? That's the same guy that she was talking about. So, you know, not only my dad's stories, but other people's stories, Mr. Frank's stories, and now the combination of knowing people who lost family members, it is really a very personal story, not just the tragedy, but it's personal.
Well, it sure is. And just to make a correction there, so as you have pointed out, Wikipedia is not always accurate. We know that. And there are a number of issues with this entry in particular, because it was written before I wrote my book. So I don't know if they've done any updates since my book came out last year. I didn't rely on Wikipedia. I actually, went to the primary sources. And Wilbur York was down on the site. He was not on the bridge.
Okay, he was on the site. He was
yeah, and there's actually a picture of his fire truck in flames in the book. The book has a number of photos from the disaster, and one of them is Wilbur York's fire truck going up in flames. And he was actually, he did not die instantly.
He didn't.
I believe it was the next day or that very late that night, that Friday night. But he had been taken, and I think it was to Vanderbilt that he ended up at Vanderbilt Hospital.
Okay. The Wikipedia doesn't mention that. It was Miss Betty, when I was talking to her, made it indicate that he died immediately, but he didn't. Okay.
Now, he was actually one of the people who was life-flighted out. Well, we didn't have life-flight at the time, even. It was the Fort Campbell helicopters that
yes,
they
Fort
called
Campbell.
At the hospital. Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at some of these pictures. The book I have was the audio book, so I didn't get the pictures in there. But I'm looking at some of these pictures, and I think I'm looking at one, Dr. Ali, and obviously you can't see what I'm looking at, but it was the lumber company.
Oh, yeah. I think that's Sladen Lumber. That's really impressive how that whole building is on fire and there's just a little bit left of it, like part of one wall that's about to come down.
Now, this was across the road, correct?
Okay.
Was that correct that the lumber company was across the road from when this took place?
Yeah. So if you... it's hard to say the road because everything was different then. What you see in Waverly now is not the way that Richland Crossing looked then.
Okay.
Yeah.
So No.
In fact, your father can chime in here. Can you remember where Sladen Lumber was in relation to Richland Crossing?
I wasn't that for me. I know Waverly's a small town, but my quote interest in Waverly was at another section, and you just go through there, and of course, again, the young people nowadays know that the Main Street Waverly isn't Main Street anymore because you go around Waverly on the bypass over there, but you go down
the
there
bypass.
Now and
yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, this long before the bypass. But, it was just, just a good old southern part of town down there.
Now, I'm looking at another picture, and I wish I could send it to you. It has a picture where they're looking down from behind the explosion, and it's looking across the road, basically, to the buildings. And it mentioned something that I know you mentioned in your book, and Mr. Frank was telling me yesterday about this. And by the way, that man's a hero. I don't care. Well, he's a hero. What he had to go through, he survived that. The blast crater was 20 foot deep. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. But, I have to check my own statistics. It's been a while since I wrote that. But it was at least 20 feet deep. That's right.
So that tells me that it tells me that everything kind of dug in, because usually explosions go up unless it's dug in. So we just have about 15 more minutes left. So can you take just a second and tell us what happened that caused the wreck?
Yes. That's key. I'm glad you asked about that. So that's a really interesting story in and of itself, because the L&N train that went through Waverly and derailed.
Louisville to Nashville, correct?
Yes, Louisville and Nashville, L&N, absolutely. Louisville and Nashville Railroad were running through Waverly at that time. And that train actually left Nashville at 6:32 p.m. that Wednesday. And it had 92 cars on it when it left Nashville, and three locomotives and one caboose. And then about 40 miles north of Nashville in Colesburg, one car was taken out of the train and five others were added. And one of those that was added was the gondola car known as car number 17. That train departed Colesburg without its brakes being properly tested. And that was a violation of federal regulations. So because of that, the handbrake on the rear wheel of that gondola car was left on. And the heat and the friction that built up as the train made its way toward Waverly caused that wheel to crack. all the way through, rim, plate, hub. It loosened the wheel from its axle and it caused it to move inward. And then when that fractured wheel hit the switch in the tracks at Richland Crossing in Waverly, where only properly aligned wheels would be able to go through, that wheel then pulled its own car, that gondola car, over on its side and derailed the 22 cars behind it, including those two 30,000-gallon tankers of liquid propane. Yeah. So this all came down to an inspection that didn't happen, a handbrake that was left on.
Now, you mentioned, and of course, I don't want to harken on this because this just take a second, but you mentioned that the railroads, you talk about this was Civil War type need to come through Johnsonville, things like that. This was something that took place because of how the Civil War operated in World War One, the movement of troops that the railroad was used for movement of troops and supplies more so than ever going to World War Two. You also had to do that because of, well, the need for everything. So 30 years later, the railroads were not as used as much. And you mentioned something about they were going bankrupt. Is that correct?
That's right. A significant percentage of our country's railroads were in bankruptcy or running bankrupt tracks at that time in the 70s. It was a real mess, and there were billions of dollars of deferred maintenance because the companies didn't have the money to put into maintaining the tracks. And so there was this phenomenon called a standing derailment, where the tracks were so poorly maintained that a car just standing there, not moving, the car would fall off the tracks, a train car fall off the tracks because the tracks were so poorly maintained.
Thus, what we have now, 1978.
That's in 1978, and now we're 46 years later, and we have been looking at a similar situation. You're right.
Now, you mentioned it again. We could have hours. I know we could. You mentioned at the beginning of the book several different train wrecks, and it's never a good thing. Trains don't stop on a dime. They don't. And if there's something wrong with one car, it's going to be a domino effect in a lot of ways, isn't it?
That's exactly right, because that's the concept of a train. All those cars are connected.
So the explosion happens, and I was watching a video. It was made back, I don't know, probably in the early 80s or probably after the explosion, that because it snowed the night before the day of the wreck, if I remember that correctly, and the temperature warmed up, that the metal expanded and the fumes were let out, and that something like that caused the explosion. I'm not a scientist in that sense. What do you know what caused it?
Yes. So a few factors. One is that the propane tank that eventually exploded was damaged when it derailed. You know, when it came off the tracks, there was structural damage there. And that structural damage was not appreciated by anyone on site, the extent of that damage. Then there was cleanup going on. And, you know, these the train wheels are like barbells, like 2-ton barbells. And the crane that was lifting one of those wheels, and Toad Smith told me this story, and I've heard it from others as well, was lifting that set of wheels over, trying to get it out of the way, and dropped the wheels on the already injured tank car.
Oh, so my there's,
yes, that was Friday morning. So that was, much, you know, 2 tons dropping on this already damaged tank car. And everyone thought then that it was going to explode. When the wheels hit that tank car, there was a big popping noise and everybody thought it was over. But nothing happened until about 5 hours later. And that was when the explosion happened. And someone, and I've never been able to identify who exactly this was, but in the National Transportation Safety Board report, someone is reported as having seen or smelled a propane gas leaking from that tank just moments before it exploded. And, you know, once propane gets out, it's so highly flammable, anything can set it afire. But there was there, and this is a sort of an infamous photograph of a crew member. I don't remember which crew he was with, whether it was with the crane or with the LNN. I think he was with one of the crane companies, sitting on top of one of the cars smoking a cigarette.
I've seen that picture. I'm like, yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So we don't know. That could have been what lit it, but there were a number of sources of ignition in the area that could have done it. So I don't know
if we'll ever know exactly. It, what. if that started, Dr. Ali, it had been leaking a long time for a little cigarette to do, but it could happen. So we had.
You have to remember there's a lot of machinery going, so a lot of friction in the area anyway.
A lot of friction, absolutely. So we got just a few more minutes, and there are two things I want to do. And then, Daddy, I want you, whatever you want to say. Number one, this started what? Federal government agency came about from the 1978 explosion?
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, Jeremy, FEMA.
FEMA. So when you hear FEMA, most people know FEMA because of Katrina, but it's there for Harvey. It's there for anything that happens. I want to say FEMA might have been here, or TEMA. It was TEMA that came here during the flood. But if you want to know where FEMA started or when it started, it was the result of this explosion.
That's exactly right. And FEMA came to Waverly's help in the flood as well. And TEMA also came out of this disaster, as Buddy Frazier will tell you. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you know what? I'm trying to remember. All I remember, Dr. Ali, about the flood is finding bodies in that it wasn't good. So I didn't realize that FEMA was down here.
Terrible, terrible.
It was terrible. Number two. You, again, my dad read the book. He knows. You make it human. And that's the thing, again, when I mentioned about history, my dad and I could tell you Civil War battles, World War II battles, that sort of stuff. But when you talk to people who were there, and obviously most generations, my dad and I went to a hospital Tuesday to visit a lady who survived the German bombings in certain cities. She was 5 years or 4 years old during bombings that the Allied did. She told stories about that she could remember. When you can make it human, it's no longer words in a book. And what you did was make it human. And that, to me, your book was great. That, to me, Dr. Ali, made it even better.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeremy.
Mr. Frank told me that when he should have died. And he told me he went to Birmingham and they flew him up to Cincinnati, and that he couldn't feel anything because the burns, well, you know, this is, as being a medical doctor, burns just basically burned off. The explosion burned off his feelings, his nerves. And they put him in a betadine wash or betadine bath. Is that what he said? And he said at that point, he wished he had died. It was that painful. And that was because of the burns. And I asked him, how many skin grafts do you have? And he said, 100%. That basically his entire body is skin graft because of where he was standing.
That's exactly right. Frank Craver had at least 70% of his body surface area burned. And, you know, any burn surgeon or specialist can tell you that the likelihood of survival is so low. Nobody can believe that Frank Craver survived this. And maybe even Frank Craver can't believe it. But he'll tell you that every part of his body was either burned or used for a skin graft to cover a burn.
And not only this day, I'll let you have the last word here. Not only is this, but Frank Craver has one of the best attitudes that you'll ever meet in a man, especially for what he has seen. If you want to feel better and blessed, you talk to Frank. That's all I can say about that.
That is so well said, Jeremy. I feel the same way. I absolutely love Frank Craver, and every life he's touched is the better for it.
All right, Daddy, you got anything you want to add?
Well, first, I'd like to thank the doctor for her book, which I know many people have, but I want to join that crowd. I thank you for the detail. And when the idea of the individuals that, and of course, you had access to the medical side of it as well, which unfortunately was massive. Thank you very much for the detail. And remembering and helping people remember by, you know, by having it in black and white. It is kind of sad, not kind of, it is sad that when you can go through Waverly, well, of course, now with the flood, but the years before that, you could go through and you could think about what happened. And let's hope that it doesn't happen again.
Amen.
All right, Dr. Ali, where can they get your book? And, let's do that. Where can they get your book?
My book is available wherever books are sold. Bookstores, libraries, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you get a book. You can type in Walk Through Fire, The Train Disaster, and that'll come up. You'll find it. And I also got it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I also have a website, Jeremy, if people want to check it out, yasmeenalimd.com. That's yasmeenalimd.com.
If you could send me that information as soon as we're off, I will put it in the show notes and they can get right to you.
I sure will.
Again, thank you for coming. This was a few days in working. We had to work out scheduling, and we're happy that it did work out. You, like I said, when you look in Waverly, type in Waverly, Tennessee, two things will come up, and two things that are very tragic. I want to say, Dr. Ali, we lost about 40 people with those two things. You think, well, 40 people, what? In a town our size, well, losing one person is terrible, period. But can you imagine two events like what we went through? And again, numbers and names don't matter, but when you put people and faces and stories to it, it becomes real. So again, thank you, Dr. Ali, for coming on today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me on.
And y'all, thank you so much for listening to the Football's Family Podcast.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
The Pigskin Tales podcast is all about the lesser-known pro football players. Yes, there are stories about the ones we know, like Brad Tarkenton and Harold Red Grange. But have you ever heard of Ernie Nevers? How about Dave Osborne or even Grady Alderman? These men created their own path to the NFL. How did they do it? Listen to the Pigskin Tales podcast, now streaming on your favorite music platform. Go to pigskintales.com.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.